Hi there and welcome. This is Amanda, the founder of Astrology Hub, and you're listening to our Week Ahead Snapshot with world-class astrologer, historian, and author of The Cosmic Calendar, Christopher Renstrom. This show is designed to give you a quick overview of the week ahead, enabling you the gift of choice in how you navigate and weave these energies into your daily life. Enjoy.
Hello, this is Joe G, Astrology Hub's podcast producer, and today I'm here to let you know that Ruling Planets for Unruly Times is officially open for enrollment. This is a three-week course led by Christopher, where you will delve deep into the meanings of the planets through history and myth, and you even get to know which one of those planets is your personal celestial guide. You'll receive 12 units of lessons in both video and audio format with transcripts and even an excerpt from the original Ruling Planets book. And you might also even want to know that you do get to hang out with Christopher on a Q&A live session where one lucky student will even get their chart read. If you want to learn more, all you have to do is go to astrologyhub.com/rulingplanets. I'll see you there.
Hello, my name is Christopher Renstrom, and I'm your weekly horoscope columnist here on Astrology Hub. And this week, I wanted to talk to you about the lunar eclipse in the zodiac sign of Scorpio taking place on May 5th. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about eclipses. The emphasis actually was on solar eclipses rather than lunar eclipses. Eclipses, which is basically a period of time when the luminaries, it can be the sun during the day or the moon, the full moon during the night, are suddenly plunged into darkness because there's a planet passing in front of them. With a solar eclipse, it's the moon passing in front of the sun, blocking its rays in the light of day. And so all of a sudden, everything gets very cold and very chilly. And at night, the lunar eclipse is associated with the full moon being overshadowed by the Earth as it moves in between the sun and the moon in the evening sky. This causes a shadow to fall upon the moon, where it looks as though it's being eaten or swallowed by some sort of dark demon, and it disappears from the sky for a short period of time. Back in ancient times, eclipses were seen as being dangerous and treacherous times, and you can sort of imagine it. I mean, this is way before we had science. This is way before we mapped out that eclipses were kind of a regular thing. And this was way before electricity. So to suddenly see the moon disappear from the nighttime sky obviously would have caused a great deal of fear and anxiety, mostly about whether it was going to reappear or not. It was also believed during the period of the eclipse that when the sun disappeared during the day or the moon disappeared during the night, that all of a sudden the denizens of the underworld would be unleashed upon the planet, that all of those spirits and demons and all those kinds of sorts would suddenly be running rampant through our streets and our houses and our cupboards, causing all sorts of mischief and havoc, if not perhaps even worse. And so this is why eclipses carried this kind of dangerous feeling, this treacherous portent into the literature of astrology itself. This week, I want to talk to you about the lunar eclipse in the zodiac sign of Scorpio. The sun, as we know, is in the sign of Taurus, and Taurus is associated basically to the good earth. Of all the earth signs, Taurus is the most optimistic because it is the sign that comes right in the middle of spring, the heart of spring. And so it's the most optimistic about planting seeds and seeing life grow. I mean, things are flowering and leafing and beginning to bloom during the season of Taurus. And so it's a time when you see the earth as being a good earth. This is a good time. And so the view of life is pretty much optimistic as it's looking forward to the season of summer, which was always associated here in the Northern Hemisphere with being a time of abundance, when there was lots of fruits and vegetables and wheat to be harvested and sheep to be shorn. Very pastoral, the tonality of the zodiac sign of Taurus, anticipating the time of summer, the season of abundance. In opposition to Taurus, and the reason why we talk about an opposition is because the moon is full when it is exactly opposite the sun in the sky. All right. As the moon approaches fullness, we see its phases as it begins to wax in its light. And then when the moon has peaked at the full moon, it begins to wane. It begins to diminish in its light. But the moon is at its peak. It's a full moon. It's the fullest light when it is exactly opposite the sun. And the sun being in the zodiac sign of Taurus automatically means that the full moon will be taking place in the zodiac sign of Scorpio, which is always a sound cue for like, ooh, full moon in Scorpio. I wonder what that portends. And the reason why people always get a little skittish when you hear the name Scorpio spoken in discreet whispers and something along the lines of a full moon in Scorpio is because Scorpio is associated with Pluto, named after the lord of the underworld. If Taurus is perhaps the most optimistic of all the earth signs because it's there in the heart of spring, Scorpio is lending itself towards the pessimism of the water signs as it's heading on into winter. Scorpio takes place at the time of year when it is the heart of autumn. It is the heart of the fall. The moon, for instance, is exalted, meaning most celebrated, in the zodiac sign of Taurus. And therefore, the moon is in fall, not exalted, not celebrated, in the zodiac sign of Scorpio. The reason of this being, of course, that the energy from the roots of trees that went into the branches and the leaves and gave full foliage during summer, well, as the sun moved into the autumnal months, the color of the leaves changes as the energy of the tree is directed up from the crown or the branches of the tree down into the roots of the tree. Down into the roots of the tree where it's going to essentially hibernate until the approach of spring again. So this energy that was going down into the roots of the trees when people would see that leaves were falling in autumn, this was seen as a return to or a journey into the underworld, a journey into the night. And so this is Scorpio's association with the underworld and the moon wanting to be most fertile in Taurus and the most abundant in Cancer, now is basically a fallen moon in the zodiac sign of Scorpio. It has retreated from giving life and vegetables and fruits above the surface of the world, and it has retreated down into the dark hole of the underworld. And this is the association with the moon in Scorpio. So as you can imagine, the full moon in Scorpio is going to have associations with the underworld, things that are dealing with roots, things are going down into the darkness of the earth itself, and things, of course, that are going back into the past. And so when we look here at Scorpio, what we see here is basically a family lineage. If Cancer is the zodiac sign that's associated to your roots and to your family, your hearth and your home, the moon in Scorpio is going to be associated really to the past generations, the things that have come before. And of course, that association comes from the Pluto, the modern rulership of Scorpio. Pluto ruled over the dead, you know, departed souls that were kept down in the underworld in the realm of Pluto, or Hades, as he was called in Greek mythology. Pluto also ruled over riches, because gold and silver and precious metals and even oil come from beneath the earth. They come from the underworld. But Pluto also ruled over seeds. And it's indeed in autumn that we see that plants and flowers have gone to seed. They're spreading their seeds on the ground to be buried by the earth or the soil, and then to dormantly wait until the return of spring. So the idea of the seed being planted, seeds that are laying dormant within the earth, these are also ideas to be associated with the zodiac sign of Scorpio and also its modern ruler, Pluto. So when we talk about seeds and we talk about families and we talk about intergenerational, okay, we're used to an idea of intergenerational wealth. Okay, there is an idea that's wealth being passed down through the family. And of course, as you can imagine, that falls within the domain of Pluto itself. But we also have intergenerational traits, intergenerational issues that are being passed down through the family root as well. And this is something that we're kind of dealing with when we're dealing with the lunar eclipse, the shadowing of the moon in the zodiac sign of Scorpio. Whereas before I said the fear was always demons or hungry ghosts being let loose, the denizens of the underworld being less let loose on the surface world because the moon and the sun weren't there to prevent them from escaping. Nowadays, it has much more of a psychological connotation in astrology. And so what you might want to sort of think about is genetic predisposition, psychological predisposition even. Maybe it's some sort of dysfunction or family pattern, or maybe it's just a series of really bad choices that have been passed down through the generations of your family that have created a kind of chain of cause and effect that are carried over from one generation to the next, to the next, to the next, and to yours, the one that you happen to be presently living in. To illustrate this idea of an intergenerational legacy, in some circles, it's referred to as an intergenerational curse. And that doesn't mean that you're cursed, you know, to have horrible things because of what happened before in your family. But it is the idea that certain things that happened in the previous generation either are being repeated in following generations or have had a very profound effect on the generations to come. And so here, I thought what might serve as an apt illustration would be a story of the House of Atreus. The story of the House of Atreus. Atreus is probably the most infamous house in all of Greek mythology. And I wanted to sort of use the story of the House of Atreus to illustrate what I'm talking about with things being passed down through the generations of a family. Now, the story begins very early in the history of humankind, when gods actually fraternized with humankind quite a bit. If you sent the gods an invitation, they would show up at a feast if you were throwing it for them and you know, maybe sort of mull and have conversation with you and some of the other guests. Okay, so this is really, really far back in the history of Greek mythology. Well, there happened to be a king at the time whose name was Tantalus. And Tantalus was throwing a party for the gods. He was throwing a feast for the gods. And the gods didn't eat normal food. They actually ate ambrosia and rarefied offerings. And so Tantalus had filled his table with this. He was throwing this banquet, but he was also serving meat as well for those deities who might be, you know, thus inclined. So a number of deities appear at Tantalus's feast. And as you can imagine, the feast looked tantalizing. And they were served all these wonderful dishes and they're enjoying themselves. And some of them are picking from the meat dish. And Tantalus suddenly announces, you know, to the gods, you know, if you're so all-knowing, if you're so omnipresent, tell me what kind of rarefied meats did you eat from on that dish? And most of the gods were like, well, I didn't, you know, really eat anything. And some of the lesser gods were kind of like, that was yummy. Was it turkey? And Tantalus says, no, it was my son Pelops. And they all like, you know, sat back aghast. They're like, what? And he's like, it was my son Pelops. I killed him and I diced him and cut him into 1,000 different pieces and sprinkled him on all this meal and on all these sumptuous meat dishes that you found so tantalizing, and you've eaten him. Ah, isn't that funny? We've always wondered why Tantalus did this, why he ever thought it was amusing. I don't know. Anyway, but he did it and he thought it was very amusing, and all the gods were completely aghast at the thought of it. And they immediately said, well, we're going to piece together Pelops and we're going to resurrect him, or we'll take what's left of Pelops on the table. That was it. We'll take what's left of Pelops on the table and resurrect him. And so they worked their godly magic and Pelops came to formation, but with a missing shoulder. And they were like, what happened to the shoulder? And Demeter was like, oops. Yes, indeed. Demeter, the goddess of the grain, because she was driven to distraction and grief, searching for her daughter, Persephone had sort of absentmindedly eaten from the meat dish and had, without knowing it, eaten Pelops' shoulder. Well, anyway, Pelops was resurrected and put together sans shoulder that was replaced with a plate of gold by Hephaestus. And Demeter, you know, apologized. And so the gods, enraged at this Tantalus, condemned him to the underworld. I think Tantalus is actually the first person to be punished down in the realm of Hades. So Tantalus immediately descends down into the underworld. And there he finds himself in a pond of water. And there's a pond of water that comes up to about maybe his knees. And he looks above himself and he sees a beautiful apple tree with apples. And he's like, oh, those look delicious. And so he reaches up to fetch an apple and the branches of the tree move out of his reach. And he's like, that's curious. And so he turns away and the branches descend again. And he reaches up for the apple and they reach out of his reach. And he's like, yeah. And he's like, well, I'll just slake my thirst by drinking from this clear water that I'm standing in. And he bent over to try to drink, and the water immediately pulled down away from him to the point that he was on his hands and knees scratching at the dirt, and there was no water to be found. And he got up and he stood, and the water immediately replenished. And he was like, and little did he know, he was condemned for an eternity, reaching for fruit that always whisked out of his reach, and down for water that always sank beneath his feet. And then reappeared once he stopped reaching. And this, of course, is where we get the word tantalizing, because Tantalus was tormented, probably still to this day and further into the future for all of eternity. So then we move on to Pelops, who's resurrected and he's showing off a brand new golden shoulder where shoulder used to be. Demeter, had eaten it at the banquet. And so, Pelops becomes a young man and he wants to sire a family, and he falls in love with this princess, Hippodama. He falls in love with Princess Hippodama. Okay, we've got that. Pelops becomes a young, strapping man, and he falls in love with the exquisite and the beautiful Hippodama. And he wants to have her hand in marriage. But Princess Hippodama had her father, who was Enomaus, King Enomaus, and he wasn't going to give away his daughter's hand so easily. King Enomaus was a champion charioteer. And so Hippodama, his daughter, was exquisitely beautiful, and all the princes throughout the different kingdoms wanted her hand, and he challenged them all to a chariot race. And he said, if you beat me at the chariot race, you can have my daughter's hand in marriage, but if I win, you must kill yourself on the spot. You know, and all the, young princes were like, wow, that's kind of like, you know, that's kind of harsh, you know, but nevertheless, they came forward and they were going to race Enomaus for his daughter's hand. And so Pelops was really crushing on Princess Hippodamus really badly. He really, really wanted her. And so what he did is that he bribed Enomaus's charioteer, Myrtilus. And he said, you know, is there any ways you can sort of like maybe loosen the wheel on his chariot so it falls off and I win? Is there any way that you can do this? And Myrtilus was like, on it. Okay, so Myrtilus does this and they have this ferocious chariot race. And at one point, the wheel falls off of Enomaus's chariot, but the chariot wipes out really badly and Enomaus is killed in the chariot crash. And Pelops is like, oh dear, my bad. Okay, but he wins, and he's celebrated. And everyone's like, okay, Pelops has the hand of Hippodamus, and you know, it's sad, but rather coincidentally, her father died, and so Pelops will be our new king to replace the dead Enomaus. But word gets out that there was funny business with the chariots, and the citizens immediately, you know, rush after Pelops, who escapes with Hippodamus and with Myrtilus in tow. And so they're on the road and they're traveling at night, and Pelops falls asleep and he awakes to hear Hippodamus's cries of help me, because Myrtilus is having his way with her. You know, he's about to, you know, have his way with her. And so Pelops, in a fit of fury, takes Myrtilus and says, I can't believe you did this. And he's like, really, you know, you hired me to kill her father. And Hippodamus is like, kill my father. And so Peebleops is like, ugh. And so he takes Myrtilus and he throws him off a cliff. Okay, he throws him off the cliff. And as Myrtilus is falling down, he cries out, he shrieks out this curse. I curse you, Peebleops, and all your descendants forever. Blah! You know, and he like splatters on the rocks below. And Peebleops is like, you know, what do I care? And Hippodamus is like, you saved me, my husband, my love. And so they marry and they have children. And they have several children, Peebleops and Hippodamus. They're quite prolific. But the most important children that we're going to be focusing on today are the two sons, Atreus and Thyestes. And Atreus and Thyestes are very querulous with one another. They're very competitive with one another. And a quarrel that they got into when they came of age was who's going to be king. And so they decide that it's the brother who owns the golden fleece of a particular lamb who should be king. And Atreus was like, well, that's easy. I happen to own a particular sheep that has a golden fleece. So, you know, this is a no-brainer. I'm going to be king. But on the day that they were to celebrate the revelation of the lamb with the golden fleece, the lamb with the golden fleece was nowhere to be found. It's almost as if it wasn't almost, it had completely disappeared. And Atreus was like, huh, what happened to my golden fleeced lamb? And instead Thyestes was like, I have the particular lamb with the golden fleece over here. Citizens, gather around me. I have, you know, let me show you this lamb with the golden fleece. And the lamb's like, you know, with golden fleece and shimmering. And everybody's like, oh, it's so bedazzling. Obviously Thyestes is king. We obey you, Thyestes. And so Atreus is furious. And he's like, I was supposed to be king. And at that moment, where Atreus is saying, I'm supposed to be king. And everyone's like, you know, tell it to the hand or the lamb, Atreus. It's obviously Thyestes. He has the lamb with golden fleece. At that moment, for some bizarre reason, the sun sets in the east. Okay, it was near sunset. It was heading down to a sunset in the west, but all of a sudden it's on the east and it sets. And this throws a shadow over the land and everyone turns around and they're like, hey, what's going on? What's going on? It must be a portent. It must be a sign from the gods. What is this lamb with the golden fleece? It's nothing in comparison to the sun. The sun setting in the east where it normally rises. That must only mean one thing, and one thing only. Atreus must be the king. We were going to award the kingship to Thyestes, but it's Atreus who's king. We're looking in the towards the other brother. We're looking from west to east, from Thyestes to Atreus, and we will award the kingship to Atreus. And Atreus is as it should be. Okay, so Atreus becomes king, and this is a wonderful thing. And Thyestes goes into exile. And Atreus finds out, because he kind of smells a rat, and he starts asking around the palace, and he finds out that his wife, Arope, has secreted the lamb with the golden fleece to his brother Thyestes, and was actually his lover. You know, they were lovers, and they were going at it all the time, and she has secreted the lamb to Thyestes and plotted behind his back. You know, so Atreus is furious with his wife, Arope, but he's really furious at his brother, Thyestes, who's in exile, but it was a temporary exile. So he decides, let's have a feast of reconciliation. And so the citizenry is like, yes, a feast of reconciliation. Actually, the citizens back then, because food was so scarce, they were always up for a feast. Okay. And one of reconciliation is a wonderful thing. So Atreus invites his brother. He says, no hard feelings, Thyestes. Please return to the castle and join with me in a feast of reconciliation. I want to bury the hatchet. I want to make amends. I want there to be a truce between the two of us. I forgive you. I'm king and I want to show off my benevolence. And Thyestes says, of course. And so he returns to the castle. And there's this beautiful banquet, all these lovely dishes. Things are so aromatic. You know, all these fruits and vegetables and lambs and hams and all sorts of things. The table's bursting and all the citizenry is happy and Thyestes is feasting and they're all feasting. And of course, you know, at towards the end of the meal, Orestes exclaims, what sort of meats do you think you have eaten? And Thyestes, sound familiar? And Thyestes answers, what sort of meats have I do I think I've eaten? Obviously, turkey and lamb and ham. And Atreus is like, ah, brother of mine, these are not the sort of meats that you suppose, but they are, in fact, your children. Yes, it gets passed down from one generation to another. I guess it was habit forming. Anyway, Atheistes is like, it's my children. And he's like, yes. And just to prove it, I'm going to show you their heads, hands, and feet. And so he, Atreus has paraded out on trays the heads and the hands and the feet of Thyestes' children. And he's like, this is awful. This is horrifying. And Atreus is like, yes, yes, it is. And he gloats in it. And the citizenry is like, oh, we thought he was a benevolent king, and now he's a tyrant king. He's terrible. And we must obey him, but this is a horrible thing. And so this causes a curse, as you can imagine, to become even more vigorous than it was before and to be passed down to the next generation. So the curse moves on to the next generation of Atreus, and the curse moves on to the next generation of Thyestes. Atreus happens to have two sons, Agamemnon and Menelaus. And Thyestes has one son, and his name is Aegisthus. The sons of Atreus, who are very well-to-do, they're the proper princes of a kingdom, Agamemnon and Menelaus, they marry the twin sisters of the twins Castor and Pollux, who are the children of Zeus. And so Castor and Pollux are twin boys. One was mortal, one was immortal. And Clytemnestra and Helen are their twin sisters. So we're really talking about quadruplets here. And Helen, who we come to know as Helen of Troy, the most beautiful woman in the world, is clearly an immortal. And Clytemnestra is her mortal sister. So Clytemnestra is married to Agamemnon, and Helen is married to Menelaus, and Aegisthus sort of hangs out on the sidelines for a little bit here. And I'm sure that more than a few of you are familiar with the story of Helen of Troy. Helen of Troy is abducted by Paris, who's a beautiful prince of Troy. We don't really know if she was abducted or whether he was her lover and she decided to go with him to Troy because Menelaus was like a pig. But anyway, she goes off with Paris to Troy, and Menelaus, shamed in front of all of Greece, you know, calls for all of the neighboring kingdoms to come together and to band against Troy. And of course, the leader of all of the Greek armies is going to be his older brother, Agamemnon. And so Agamemnon calls all the kingdoms together. They put together 1,000 ships, and there are 1,000 ships that are going to launch to go and retrieve Helen from Troy. And they're about to launch, and they're all ready to launch, when all of a sudden there is no wind. The wind just dies. And so launch day is postponed for a week, for a month, for several months. I think it gets up to maybe about a year. There is still no wind. And so Agamemnon sends out word to find out why the wind has ceased, why it will not blow in the direction of Troy like it usually does. And he finds out that I think a sacred deer to Artemis had been killed by one of the Greek soldiers who were like playing in the woods for sport. And as a result, Artemis has, we know her as Diana, goddess of the moon, has brought to an end the wind. She will not allow it to exist. And so they must do something for reparation. They have to make it up to her in some sort of way. And so Agamemnon asks, okay, how can we make this up to the goddess Diana, the goddess of the beasts? And obviously we killed a sacred beast of hers. Oh, I know. It was a sacred beast because the deer was pregnant with a fawn. And Diana, or Artemis, is the protectress of animals who are pregnant with baby animals. And so that's what had been killed. And so she was outraged about this and stopped the wind. And so they find out from an oracle that the wind will reappear when Agamemnon kills or performs a human sacrifice to Artemis of his daughter Iphigenia. Agamemnon has two daughters, Iphigenia and Electra. And there's a son in there too, Orestes. I think he's born between the... It goes Iphigenia, Orestes, and Electra. But Iphigenia is much older, or she's like of marriageable age, which back in ancient Greece was 13 or 14. And Agamemnon promises Iphigenia's hand to Achilles, the most celebrated soldier in the Greek armies. And so she comes to marry Achilles. She's dressed in white and she has flowers in her hair. And Clytemnestra, Queen Clytemnestra, is so proud of her daughter. And she's so happy to deliver her daughter to Achilles, who was the most famous hero in all of Greece. And they come accompanied with maids and handmaids and things like this, servants. And they come expecting a wedding, only to find that it's actually a sacrifice. Clytemnestra hears this in front of everyone at that moment. And the marriage party, a silence falls over them. And Clytemnestra begins to say something, and Iphigenia steps forward and says, "If this is what you need to do, Father, to bring the winds to Troy and to make great the glory of our armies, I give you my arms, my wrists. You may tie them, and you can make a sacrifice of me." And Clytemnestra is like, "No, no, no." She cries out, "You will not make a sacrifice of our daughter." You know, and Agamemnon just, you know, gestures, and Clytemnestra is taken away. "Stop playing. Such a thing is happening." And Iphigenia follows her father to the altar. And there he binds her hands behind her back, and he binds her feet and ankles behind her back, so that she is laying on the altar like a deer. And he slits her throat. And the blood pours, and the howling cries of Clytemnestra can be heard on the winds, which are now blowing in the direction of Troy. So the ship set off for Troy. And there's an extraordinary war that's fought, which is called the Trojan War, and it lasts for 10 years. And the war is brought to an end through the trickery of the Greeks, particularly Odysseus, in building the Trojan horse, which fools the Trojans. They bring it in as a trophy, not knowing that it's full of Greek soldiers who then come out of the Trojan horse at night and kill, basically. If they don't kill all the men in Troy, they get very close to it, and the mothers and daughters are taken into slavery. And so this is Agamemnon's big moment of triumph. This was why his daughter was sacrificed. This is why so many Greek men died. 10 years later, they are the victors of Troy, and they are ready to sail home. And so they take the spoils. Troy is left burning. They take the queen of Troy, the princesses of Troy. Agamemnon takes as his prize the princess Cassandra, the prophetess who can see into the future, but who was cursed by Apollo that nobody would ever believe her. And so she becomes the trophy, the concubine is a polite way of putting it. Sex slave is more like it, to Agamemnon, and he sails back for home in triumph. And once again, the winds play havoc with the ships. Some ships are blown off in this direction. Some ships are blown off in a different direction. Odysseus goes on an extraordinary adventure that lasts for years because his ship is also blown off course. Menelaus, returning with Helen, his wife, his ship is blown off course to Egypt. The only ship that is not blown off course, the only ship that returns to Greece promptly, is the ship of Agamemnon. So Agamemnon returns to his kingdom, and what he discovers is that his wife Clytemnestra is there with welcoming hands. She wants him to come and enjoy a feast, and he's like, "Oh, I'm so hungry after all these years. You know, I'm hungry for my own food, the native menu of my beloved Greece." And Clytemnestra is, "I'm preparing a lovely banquet. I can't wait for you to come and indulge in it." And Cassandra reaches for Agamemnon's shoulder, and she says, "Do not go in there. Do not go in there." And he's like, "What are you talking about?" And she's like, "Do not go into that palace. Do not go into that palace." And he's like, "What is it with you?" And she's like, "Blood, blood. I see it streaming from the parapets. I see it streaming from the windows. Blood, that palace is full of blood." And he slaps her and he says, "Quiet, slave. I'm enjoying the return to my kingdom and to my wife." And Clytemnestra is like, "Cassandra, is that your name? You poor thing. Why didn't you come in as well? Why didn't you come as well? Because I want you to participate in this feast of thanks and welcome. But before we have this feast of thanks and welcome, well, you both must be very tired and very exhausted after your journey home. I want you to come and have a wonderful bath. A wonderful bath full of petals and perfumed waters, where you may refresh yourself before the banquet." And Agamemnon is like, "Yeah, babe, lead the way." And Cassandra is like, "No one will believe me. No one will believe me. No one will believe me." As she is also led into the palace. Moments later, half an hour later, we hear horrible screams from the palace itself. Horrible cries of agony. And screams of wounded and pain. And then silence. Silence descends upon the palace. And the citizens come to its doors and they're like, what's happened? What's happened? Someone was crying for their life. There are many voices. There's been horrible commotion. What has happened? I have a bad feeling about this. Something horrible has happened. And at that moment, the gates of the palace are opened and out rolls a wagon. A wagon. And on the wagon are the bodies of Cassandra and Agamemnon, dead. And behind the wagon is Clytemnestra, holding her blade, saying, "Look, look at what happens to the criminals. Vengeance has a long memory. Vengeance has a long reach. And it has been done. Exercise today. Exercise today. In the memory to make justice happen, to deliver justice for the criminal death of my daughter Iphigenia all those years ago. Now Agamemnon lies dead with his mistress Cassandra, the great prophetess of Troy." And standing next to Clytemnestra is Aegisthus, Thyestes' son. Thyestes, who had lost all of his children and later on had a child, Aegisthus. Aegisthus is still there, and he had become the lover of Clytemnestra and helped her with the murder of Agamemnon. And so Agamemnon is just thrown onto the dirt, and Clytemnestra turns around with Aegisthus and says, "I'm hungry, aren't you? There's a wonderful feast that awaits." And the palace doors close behind them. Electra, the youngest daughter, who is treated like a slave. Her mother ignores her. Electra collects the bodies of Agamemnon and Cassandra, and she has them buried. Because to leave a body unburied is to trespass against the god of the dead. All bodies are buried. And she has them buried. And for years afterward, she comes and she pours libations over, which is an oil, a holy oil, over the grave of her father. And Electra grows into full womanhood. And actually, she's a little older than that. So she's probably into, well, you know, back then, it's like mid-20s to late 20s. That's, you know. So anyway, she's about that age. And she's praying every day. She's praying every day for the return of her brother Orestes, who was cast out by Aegisthus and Clytemnestra years before. And so she comes to the grave of her father one day, and she sees sandal prints. And this is strange because no one comes to the grave of her father. All of the citizens that owe allegiance to the house of Atreus do not come to the grave of Agamemnon, not while Clytemnestra and her soldiers are alive. And so she sees footprints, and she wonders, Who could have come here? Could it perhaps be Orestes? And at that moment, she hears, psst, psst, and she turns around, and hidden behind the cypress trees that always lined the grounds of the dead, steps out Orestes, and he introduces himself to his sister. I don't know if you'd recognize me, but, and she's like, I know who you are, I know. You're Orestes, returned at last.
I know.
And he's like, Electra. And they embrace. And Electra says, do you know about, and Orestes like, I know completely what had happened. A scandal like that isn't treated, you know, lightly. Everyone is talking about it in all the different cities of Greece. And they're talking about the House of Atreus, and the House of Atreus is a befouled name. And I'm here to get vengeance. And Electra's like, vengeance? And he's like, yes, I'm here to get vengeance on our mother, Clytemnestra. And Electra's like, what kind of vengeance? And he's like, I'm going to kill her, because that's the only thing that can be done. And Electra is like, is it really? Well then, let me help you. And so Electra helps her brother sneak into the palace at night. And there Orestes slits the throat of Aegisthus, and he comes upon his mother, and Clytemnestra wakes up, and she cries out, and she's like, no, your queen is being killed. And the citizens once again of the House of Atreus gather around, and she cries out, save me, someone save me. The doors of the palace open, and Orestes emerges with blood, as does Electra, spreading the blood over her face and her hair in glee. And Orestes lowers his mother's body to the ground, and Electra looks at it and spits and kicks it. And Orestes is a little bit horrified, you know, and he looks at his mother, and Electra looks at her mother, you know, and is really sort of moving the blood through her hair, almost as if it's a shampoo or a body soap. She's letting the blood fill the pores of her skin. And Orestes all of a sudden is like, and Electra's like, what's up? And he falls upon the ground, frothing at the mouth in an epileptic fit, you know, and he's writhing on the ground. He's frothing at the mouth. His eyes are like rolling up into his head. And Electra's like, what is it? And he gets up and he's like, do you see them? And Electra's like, see what? See me? What are you talking about? There's no one here. But the citizens, and he's like, they're here. And he races off and she's like, who's there? And he cries out, the kindly one. And so Orestes goes racing into the night. And the citizens immediately, when they hear the name, the kindly ones, they group together, and Electra herself changes her demeanor. She's like, the kindly ones.
Oh, gods, no. Not them.
And so the kindly ones swoop in like spirits of vengeance. They swoop in and they follow Orestes, snarling, growling, and snapping at his feet, like dogs, the kindly ones. They race ahead of him. They race around him. They snap behind him. They drive him into the woods. They drive him into the lands outside of Atreus. They drive him into the other kingdoms. And the other kingdoms, hearing Orestes. Orestes is hounded by the kindly ones. Drop the drawbridge. Shut the doors. Close the windows. It's the kindly one. And so Orestes can find no solace. He can find no place to rest. They follow him constantly. And he hears his mother's voice again and again, calling, saying, kindly ones, follow him, torment him. Don't ever let him find peace. And they don't, because they take great glee from this. The kindly ones are known as the Furies. And if you remember from an episode that we had a few weeks ago about the birth of Aphrodite, how she was born from the castrated genitals of Uranus, and up from the foam of his semen and blood arose Aphrodite in the Mediterranean seas, the blood part of that formula, the blood that also bubbled to the surface of the ocean, around the foam of Aphrodite. This was Furies, and that is their real name. The Furies, the goddesses of vengeance, that when blood has ever been spilled, they snarl and they grasp and their eyes alight and they smell the smell of the sweat of the pursued, and they follow the criminal soul wherever it goes. And so they are known as the Furies. They are known as the Furies. And the thing that they revenge more than anything, the thing that they revenge more than anything is the blood of a mother. If a mother's blood is spilt by an abusive husband, by anyone who treats her shabbily, the Furies, they smell the sweat, they smell the fear, and like a pack of dogs with writhing snakes in their hair, they pursue the criminal soul until they die. And this is what's going on with Orestes. Orestes is turned away from every town, from every kingdom, from every home. And Orestes, when he's not running, is suffering an epileptic fit where he cannot. And this is how tormented he is. And so, obviously, as you can tell, he gets to a point where he's bruised, he's scraped, he's near naked, he's starving, he's hungry, he cannot eat, he cannot sleep, he cannot plead to someone else to help him. And he's on literally death's door, on Hades' door. And the god Apollo appears to him in an orb of light. And he says, "You must be Orestes." And in that moment, because Apollo, the god of the sun, the god of healing, the god of plagues, in that moment, the luminous Apollo says, "You must be Orestes." And in that moment, his mind clears, his breath clears, his chest releases. He can think clearly. He can see this glowing light. And he says, "You are Apollo?" And he's like, "Yes, I am. And I'm here to help you." And Orestes holds Apollo's ankles and he says, help me, please help me." And Apollo says, "I will help you once you go to the city of Athens. You must go to the kingdom of Athens. You must go to the temple of Athena, and you must throw yourself down on her mercy. Athena will help you, and I will join you there." And so Orestes travels for days and weeks, perhaps months, again pursued by the Furies, but he finds Athens, and he finds the temple of Athena, and he throws himself down on the floor. At the foot of her statue is what he does. And at that moment, the Furies stop and they back away, because this is the temple of Athena. They back away, still snarling, still sniffing, still threatening, but they cannot approach. And Athena appears before Orestes. And she says, "So you're the one who caused all of this trouble." And he's like, And Apollo says, "That's not quite the entire story." And Athena's like, "Really? What's going on here?" And Apollo says, I am declaring a court. I want to defend Orestes and his charge of matricide." And the Furies are like, "Yes, matricide. And we will take on the prosecution." And Athena says, "Okay, then I will be the judge." And the citizens of Athens, who have all gathered at the temple because of all of this ruckus, she says, "The citizens of Athens shall be the jury." And so they have this marvelous trial. They have this extraordinary trial where the Furies bring up all of the mess that I've talked to about, the things that come down through the centuries of this family or the generations of the family. And Apollo listens to all of it. And Apollo says, finally, "Well, we must do something to bring an end to all of this. This cannot continue to be eye for an eye, blood for blood, tooth for tooth. We must see an end to this. And the Furies are like, well, what kind of end are we to see? And Apollo, of course, says, Clytemnestra herself is not blameless. Clytemnestra killed her husband. There's that blood. And Furies are like, well, what do we care about husbands? They're usually the ones who kill mothers. And he's like, exactly. And so that's something that we also have to bring into account. And so they go back and forth with deliberations. The jury hears both sides. And then Athena turns to the jury and she says, you need to vote. You will now vote. This, by the way, is the origin of our jury system. It comes from this story of Orestes. And so the jury votes and they are exactly split. They're exactly split as to what will happen to Orestes. Half of the jury finds him guilty and half of the jury finds him really innocent, but there was just cause. And Athena, being the goddess, the patron goddess of Athens, and being the judge, casts the deciding vote. And of course, she casts the vote on the side of acquittal. And Orestes is acquitted. And so what this basically does is bring to an end this curse that has come down through the house of Atreus. And so the Furies are not to be appeased. They're salivating, they're spitting, they're furious. They are called the Furies. And so Athena addresses them and she says, I will address you as your name, your true name, which is the Furies. And they're like, you dare to speak our name? And she's like, yes, I will not call you the Kindly Ones, which is the name that everyone calls you for fear of you terrorizing them in their lives. For fear of that they were to call you the Furies, that you would pick up their scent and you would go after them. That's why they call you the Kindly Ones. But I will do you and show you the proper respect of calling you by your true and ancient names, the Furies. And they're like, yes, goddess of wisdom, what do you have to say? And she says, I would like to make a deal. They're like, what? And she's like, I would like to invite you to become a part of Athens. Become a part of Athens? What do you mean? I would like you to change your guise from vengeful spirits hunting down criminal souls. I would like you to change your demeanor, to change your aspect, and to take on the mantle of being the guardians of Athens. The guardians of Athens? Yes, I would finally give you a home, so that you don't have to go sniffing after the next culprit, that you could leave those affairs to the affairs of humankind. And I will give you a home here in Athens where you will be regarded, where you will be placed, and you will be seen as the guardians of Athens, something that's much more constructive and much more suited to your divine nature instead of sniffing through the garbage heap of human sins and murders. You can become the proud guardians that you are here in the city of Athens. And they look at her and they're like, well, it's been a long time since someone talked to us like that before. And another one said, I don't think I've ever been spoken to like that before. And she shows us respect and the people would love us and not despise us. And we would have a home, at last a home, instead of chasing down fugitive spirits. We would have a home we could call our own. Yes, yes, Goddess Athena, we will become the guardian spirits of Athens. And so here we have, as an example, the first jury, the first court trial. This is where basically what happened in the history of Greece is that there's a transition from family feud to courts of law. And so this brings another layer of civilization to the life of Greece. And it is a tremendous gift that Athena and the story of Orestes has given all of us here, a trial by jury and in the courts where both sides of a case are heard, in which we watch this argument, this conversation take place between both sides that examines evidence and motivation. And then we thus judge on the end of the matter. And this is held to be a virtue here in our civilization. It's not always practiced well, but is nevertheless a virtue. It's something that is embraced as being a very important thing, a part of a democratic society. But what does this offer us? What does this offer us as a story of the lunar eclipse in the zodiac sign of Scorpio? Scorpio stands for those things that we can't stand about ourselves. Okay, they stand for our inner, Scorpio stands for our inner demons. Scorpio is a zodiac sign that's associated with justice. Libra is the letter of the law. Sagittarius is the spirit of the law. And Scorpio is eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. It's hungry justice. It's pained justice. It's a crime that's screaming out to be avenged. And if it's not going to be avenged, then it needs to be seen. It needs to be heard so that what's being passed down through a community or what's being passed down through the generations of family, this outrage is finally seen. It's finally understood and it is finally set right. And this is something that happens as a process because, of course, with the acquittal of Orestes, and it's not an acquittal saying, oh, that's fine, Orestes, you didn't do anything bad. Orestes knows what he's done is bad. He has this horrible guilty conscience. But at that moment of his acquittal, the story of the House of Atreus comes to an end. We hear no more about Electra. We hear no more about Orestes. They disappear. They and seemingly to go on to live normal lives. But this idea of things being passed through generations, when will it be settled? When will it be settled? It can't be settled with eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, because nothing can satiate that hungry, kindly one. Okay, the damage and the awfulness has been done. So what must be done is taking the next step of rectifying, making right what has been wrong. You may not get your pound of flesh, okay, but you can get some sort of peace, whether it's peace that comes through a forgiveness, if you can manage it, peace that comes from, not peace, but a settlement perhaps of a sorts that comes from seeing justice served or punishment levied. You know, what might come from maybe turning to a member of the family in which this bad behavior has played out over and over again, or perhaps at times turning away from a family, from the family that you were raised in, and turning to the family that you've chosen for yourself, because they will understand you in ways that the family that you were raised in won't or perhaps can't. But the thing is, what we find at the end of all of this is that we need to excavate the demons, the ghosts of what have come before. We need to see it, and we need to, at least in our own lives, honor the kindly ones. We must, in our own lives, honor the kindly ones. Turn our direction, turn our gaze away from pursuing this endless pursuit of what has been wrong, what is wrong, and wanting some sort of compensation for it, to some kind of psychological or spiritual or psychic acquittal, so that we can quit the demons that pursue us. And it is by quitting the demons that pursue us that we lay to rest these hungry, hungry ghosts. That's something that I hope that you will keep in mind during this time that we are going through the lunar eclipse in the zodiac sign of Scorpio.
This podcast is presented by Astrology Hub. You can learn more and find all of our shows at astrologyhub.com/podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and hit subscribe on your favorite podcast platform so you can stay up to date on the latest episodes and help more people find the wisdom of astrology. Thank you for taking the time to do this now. Thank you for being a part of our community and for making astrology a part of your life.